Okay. Yesterday we said that Hashem is first and without beginning and without end, and He created and continues to create everything that exists, and we can't grasp His real nature. But we can know about what He does, how He functions, His will, and we know that there's no deficiency, nothing lacking, no weakness. Now, He says something which I'll just describe to you, though I cannot really explain it. He says, these things we know by tradition from the patriarchs and from the prophets, and the whole Jewish people at Sinai grasped these things clearly, and then they taught them to their generations, to their children, generation after generation, until now. Because Moses commanded them to communicate it from generation to generation. It means that these propositions could be known through prophecy. Now, I don't know what you think of when you hear the word prophecy. When I think of prophecy, I think of an experience, like a vision, some kind of vision, or some kind of sort of like a dream, but very powerful and very, very concentrated, something like that. Ramchal says, and Amir Hashem, we'll get to it later in this book, that in prophecy, a person becomes aware of certain truths. Certain information is communicated to him, and it's communicated in an absolutely certain way, a way which gives no possibility of error. Now, how do you communicate information in an experience? So, certain types of information, that's obvious. You know, you all know that there are tables in this room. You know it because you're looking at them, leaning on them. And you know that you're a human being, that you're male, that you're so and so many years old, and that you're in Jerusalem, not someplace else. These things you know because you've had certain experiences. And you know something about how the world works. Helium balloons float upward, and stones fall downward. But abstract propositions, propositions about the nature of God, I don't know how you would communicate them in an experience. Even information about people, could you experience that a person is honest? I mean, you could see him over and over again. You could see him in tempting situations where he had a chance to steal or a chance to lie, and he didn't do it, and a chance where he took a loss because he told the truth, and you could form the impression over a period of time that the person is honest. But could you sort of just meet him and somehow see him and feel that there's honesty there? I don't know how you would do that. I haven't had any such experience. What this tells us is that prophecy is an experience utterly unlike the kinds of experiences that we have. It's a little bit like trying to explain to a blind person what it is to see something. Imagine someone who's blind from birth. What would you say? What words would you use? I'm standing over here and I can tell what the shape of the thing is over there without going over and touching it. Then that's got to be a mystery. How can you do that? Shape. Shape is what you feel. No. There's something else. In addition to feeling shapes, you can see shapes. What's that? He doesn't know what that is. And my ability to see gives me information, because I can see that it's square without touching it. And to him, that's a total mystery. How could you know that it's square without touching it? Well, I have a special way. I have a special way. I can prove it to him. I say to him, you get something from your house and bring it here, hold on to it, and I won't touch it, and I'll tell you what shape it is. So he goes home and he gets a ball, and he brings it in. I say, it's a sphere. And he says, how did you do that? You didn't touch it, so how do you know that it's a sphere? I said, well, you know, I just saw it. That's an himda, the word saw means nothing. So what we're being told here is that there is a kind of experience, an experience that none of us has ever had. I mean, well, I can't speak for you, but I can tell you that I've never had it. And in this experience, certain truths become obvious. Certain pieces of information become obvious. Avos knew this because they were all prophets. The Jewish people knew it at Sinai because at Sinai the whole of the Jewish people became prophets. And then they handed it down as a tradition from those who had those experiences. So that's the first thing that he says. These truths are part of our information base because they were revealed to the patriarchs and the whole Jewish people in prophecy. However, he says, also via logical analysis, these principles can be verified. You could use logic and you could verify these principles. Now, nowhere in his corpus of writing does he explain how this can be done. So, I wouldn't even speculate what he has in mind. I've never seen anyone comment as to what he has in mind. But since, as I told you, he says above that you have to know means to be based on reason, not just based on tradition. That's what we said yesterday. And you see here in these two paragraphs, one after the other, that he's saying both things. There is a tradition, and you can know it by tradition, but it can also be known independently through logic, and you are responsible to do that. Using such scientific disciplines as physics, astronomy, you can get certain general principles, and from those general principles, these ideas can be derived. But we're not going to go to length about that subject here. We're just going to recite what the principles are and then base our discussion on that. Now, I do want to just make one comment in terms of intellectual method. Let's suppose that you're investigating a theory, and you want to know whether it's a good theory or not. Really, there are two things you need to do. Number one, you have to study what the theory says. And then you have to study what evidence is for the theory, what objections are against the theory, how strong it is, and how well it can be supported. Which of these do you think should be done first? Analyzing what it says or looking to the evidence? Analyzing what it says. Because if you don't know what it says, you can't tell what is evidence and what isn't evidence. Obviously, you have to know what it says before you can go around figuring out whether it's true or false. This is a book about what it says. This book tells us what the Jewish tradition says. And that's why, in order of study, it's a very good book to go through, because then you know what we're asserting, what we're responsible for. And then you can analyze what kinds of evidence there is in favor and fulfill his requirement that come to know it via reason. Now, as most of you know, from the fact that I'm sitting here, I am convinced there is reason, and I've written about it. And in other shiurim, especially in December, when the external groups come in, I go through the reasons. So I'm not going to do that here, but I want you to know there are reasons. And some of them are based on logic, and some of them are based on external evidence, and there is sufficient reason. I'll give you just one little example. How could we know that God is one? There's only one creator. So if you accept, as we do, that God is all powerful, there are no limits to his power, then his unity comes out right away. Why?
Because if there's another, then he's not all powerful.
Because imagine there are two, right? And suppose they disagree. Who's going to win? If there are two, and they're equal, then neither one is all powerful. There can only be one who's all powerful. So once you put in the idea of being all powerful, unity falls out immediately. It's not a problem. You can't have two all powerful beings. And there are reasonings like that, which help to organize the ideas and show that some of the ideas imply other ideas. They internally can show you, at least based on one thing, how another thing follows. And then, as I said, there's external evidence as well.
Yeah, but you said that since we know that he is all powerful, there could only be one thing that is all powerful. But the question said, how do we know that God is one? Not how we know that God is one and are all powerful. Can he just be all powerful and there be another thing that is subject to his power, but it's another thing, so he's not only.
Well, here it depends about what you mean by God. Could God be a table? I mean, there are limits here beyond which the language won't let you go. I'm talking about God now. I'm not talking about, Peter Smith, and I'm not talking about tables, and I'm not talking about Beethoven's symphony. I'm talking about God. A being that isn't all-powerful doesn't even qualify as a candidate for God. Okay. The next item is that God's existence is necessary. It's impossible that he should cease to exist. Here, too, I can only describe the impact of the idea. I can't really define it. I don't know that in modern philosophy we have any way to understand this. When you say that something is necessary, you usually mean it's necessary for something else. He must be home. Why must he be home? Because his keys are on the table. So, his keys don't walk. If his keys are on the table, then he's home. It's not that he has to be home, but if his keys are on the table, then it has to be that he's home. His being home is necessary because the keys are on the table. He could have gone anywhere. He didn't have to be home. Nothing was stopping him from going to the beach. He just happens to be home. But I know he's home. That's what I mean when I say he must. Must because something else is there, the keys, and the keys imply that he's home. But most of the time, when we say something must be, what we mean is, I know something else, and because of something else, this follows. That's why the word must is very weak. If somebody tells you it must be, you should immediately be suspicious. That means he doesn't really know. What he means is, he's got something else, he's inferring it from that, but he doesn't know it directly. Must is always a sign of, I would say it's a sign of relative weakness. And you're allowed to call me on it when I say it as well. When I say it as well, I mean the same thing. I mean it's followed in something else, not that I know it directly. If that's what's meant, then it's something like this. The world exists. How does the world exist? What brought it into existence? What keeps it going? What's behind it? If you appreciate that the world can't make it on its own, then you can infer there must be something behind it. You can call that God. But that means God must exist because the world is here. It's like him being home because the keys are on the table. That doesn't say he must exist. It just says that if we want to explain why there's a world, we have to have a God behind it. Maybe a little bit like the Big Bang, you know? Who banged it? Didn't bang all by itself? You know, it just happened. Usually, you don't accept that kind of answer. It just happened. So, if you don't accept it usually, so over here, such a gigantic effect. Just to say it happened is like just ignoring the question. But that means I'm starting with the world and saying, well, here's a world, that's for sure, we're living in it. And then to explain the world, I have to have something behind it that makes it go. But that doesn't mean that all that means is that because there's a world, we need to understand there's something behind it making it go. It's not saying more than that. It's not just saying that his existence is necessary in and of itself. Not because I need him to explain the world. What would that mean? I can give you a little bit of a hint, but it's not really equivalent. This table. Somebody manufactured this table, or purchased it, and it's sitting here. It could have been dismantled yesterday. It could have been burnt up yesterday or discarded yesterday. It wasn't. That's why it's here today. But it could have been dismantled. This thing doesn't have to exist. It happens to exist. It just happens to be here. Listen carefully. Why do I say it doesn't have to exist? Because somebody made it. And somebody could destroy it. So clearly, it doesn't have to exist. The guy who made it could have decided to take a vacation that day and never have made this table. This table could have just not come into existence. He could have left off making brown tables and from then on made green tables. It just so happens he decided to make this brown table, that's all. Now, let's compare that with the number six. Who manufactured the number six? Where is it stored? Could we dismantle it and discard it in favor of six and a half? You know, or minus six? Could we destroy it? You know, burn it up? The number six is really not like the table. We don't have any concept of manufacturing it. We don't know how we manufacture it. We don't have any concept of destroying it, moving it around, changing it. It just seems to be there, all by itself. It doesn't need people to think about it. After all, there have to be numbers that no one's ever thought about, don't there? Why? Because there's an infinity of numbers, right? And there will never be enough people to think about all of the infinity of numbers. So there got to be numbers that nobody's ever thought about. Numbers don't need us to think about them. The way we normally think, we normally understand it, even before there were human beings, there were numbers. There was a number of planets, and a number of animals before people, and a number of grass blades before animals. And so, numbers just they aren't part of our world in that way. They're a different kind of thing. Now, the philosophers have words for that. They call them abstract as opposed to concrete. Many feel that the existence of numbers is necessary, period. Not necessary for something else. Not because the keys are on the table. Not because there are tables to count. After all, it might be that the whole universe is finite. It goes up to a certain size and stops. That might be. And the stuff in it might be finite. They estimate there are 10 to the 78 or so elementary particles. That's a finite number. It's a big one. That's a finite number. Then there'll be numbers that go beyond everything in the universe. That's okay. The numbers go on forever. So, the numbers don't have to count anything. Nobody has to think about them. You know, I'm just telling you this because it's a piece of scientific... sounds like a joke. One of the models that they use, that they talk about, one of the models of a universe is a universe that has nothing in it and is rotating. Now what you have to imagine is nothing rotating. It's empty. It's all empty and it's going round and round. What's going round and round? Empty space is going round and round. Okay? Now, if you understand that, it's terrific. But numbers there are. Numbers there are. Because the numbers don't have to count anything. So here's a concept of something which exists just because of itself. It doesn't need anything else. It's not related to anything else. You could use it. You could relate it if you want to. And if you need to, you don't have to. It doesn't have to be related to anything else. Here's an idea of something whose existence is necessary in and of itself. It is just because it is. It didn't start and it won't end, and you can't destroy them and change them and make more of them. They just are. Something like that is true about God. Something like that. It's not only that, because we have a world and we have to explain how it exists, we say there's a God who makes it exist. That's true, but that's not the whole story. More than that, His existence is absolutely necessary, something that is not dependent upon anything else. Not dependent upon anything else. No one has to think of Him, and no one has to interact with Him. He doesn't have to be doing anything. His existence is absolutely independent and necessary. Combine two paragraphs, basically. And then he says something which he takes again from Maimonides, slight change of terminology. He says that God is a metzius pashut. Pashut means the opposite of compound. Not compound. And if you translate it as simple, all sorts of false associations come up in your mind. So I'd rather say not compound. It's not compound, not combined. Not composite. The Rambam takes this from the Shema. In the Shema, we say that God is one. Hashem is one. I've mentioned to some of you, I'll reiterate it briefly. Strictly speaking, if you say Hashem is one, you are saying nothing at all. You think of this as monotheism, that there is only one God? That's not what it says. And I'll prove it to you. Let's imagine a Greek, an ancient Greek. He believes in all the Greek gods. I don't know, about 16 of them. Or maybe there are more. I can't remember how many. So this guy believes in Zeus and Minerva and Apollo and Athene and a whole bunch of them. Now this guy says, Zeus is one. Is that right or wrong?
That's right.
Sure, it's right. Zeus is one of them. But Zeus is one. Zeus isn't the committee. Right? Zeus isn't the trio. Zeus is one. One of the gods. See, if a polytheist, a believer in many gods, can say Zeus is one, what great principle am I expressing if I say that Hashem is one? Sure, Hashem is one. One of what? One of many, maybe. Who knows? Saying Hashem is one really says nothing, because when you use a name of something, it's a name of one thing. That's the way names are used. Zeus is one, Ludwig van Beethoven is one, the Eiffel Tower is one, Antarctica is one. They're all one, of course, because the word is used to name a thing, and the thing is one thing. So we really have nothing here of any interest, nothing here of any content. Now, the Rambam has one approach to this. The Kabbalists have a different approach. Not that they disagree. It's all true. The Rambam's approach is this. When you say that Hashem is one, you don't just mean there's one of Him and not three of Him. What you mean is one is the only number that applies to Him for any purpose, in any connection, in any dimension. Whenever you talk about God, the only number that could be relevant is one. No other numbers are relevant. So what? Well, Maimonides says, and this he says actually in the Mishnah Torah, as well as the God. If you say that God is one in every dimension, for every purpose, in every connection, it follows immediately that God is not a physical object. Why? Because physical objects have parts. Most of them, right? They have parts. The table has legs and a top. So it's got at least five parts. Well, that's five, not one. Physical objects have parts, then God can't be a physical object. Because the only number that applies to God is one. And if you'll tell me, Maimonides actually considers this, that you have a physical object without parts. We believe in physics today that there are such physical objects, like an electron or a photon, but not a proton or a neutron. Even so, it has different aspects. For example, some of them are spinning. And if they're spinning, then they have a north pole and a south pole. And then they have different qualities. A particle has spin, it has a mass, it has an electric charge. But with God, you can use the word, the number one and only one. So, it follows that God isn't a physical object, and it also follows what we said yesterday, that you can't talk about God. Because the minute we start talking, we don't stop so fast. What would we like to say about God? Well, God is all-knowing, and God is all-powerful, and God is just, and God is kind. That's four. Should we go on? It'll just get worse. Should we have six or seven? We left one behind already. So if really God is one, and one in every respect, we can't talk about Him, because we don't talk that way. When we start talking, we have lots of things to say. It would be impossible for us to pick out one and say, okay, let's just say He's loving and leave everything else out. It won't help, because then He could be your uncle. That more He can be God. Now, Lutzata's way of putting it is this. God is absolutely non-compound, non-composite, without parts, without any combinations, no multiplicity. And he gives an analogy, and which is a contrast as well, the human soul. The human soul has many powers, different powers. And each one has its own definition. For example, you have memory, which is one kind of thing that the human soul has. And you have will, and your imagination. Each one is different from the others. Memory is not will, and will is not imagination, and hopefully imagination is not memory. Otherwise, you're going to be in serious trouble. Now, when you speak of God, it's not true that you have God, and then you have many powers that He has, and each power is a separate power, because then you have God as a composite. He would be a being with various powers. So it's not like that. If you say that God is wise, and you say He wills, you cannot think of it as, here's God, and He has wisdom, and He has will. So that's already giving you two different powers. And there can't be any multiplicity, or God can't be a composite, a collection, combination of things. Rather, it is that His one nature contains all these things as a single thing. And that's very hard for us to understand. I'll give you an analogy in something that we can't understand. And the trouble is, we can understand the analogy, but we can't understand how it applies to Him. Now, I suppose some of you have studied geometry. Okay, I know it's a painful subject, but I'm not going to do much. You know what an equilateral triangle is? Three equal sides. You know what an equiangular triangle is? Three equal angles, right? How are they related? It's the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. Even though the words don't say the same thing, somebody asks you to check, is it equilateral? You take out a ruler and you measure all three sides and see if the sides are all equal. Somebody asks you to check whether it's equiangular, they got a protractor, and you check whether all the angles are 90 degrees. So, 60 degrees. So, but when you reflect on it, the only way you can get all the angles equal is if all the sides are equal. The only way you can get all the sides are equal is if all the angles are equal. So you, if you want, you could say that having the same identical three sides and having identical three angles, in the end, is really the same thing. Because you can see that the one and the other necessarily go together. So even though the words are different, You can see that they come to the same thing. Okay, now, what we'd really like to do is import that idea and apply it to God. What we would like to say is, all of God's powers, all of His characteristics, all come down to the same thing. But if you take wisdom, and you take will, and you take goodness, it's not at all obvious how to do that. How can wisdom come down to goodness? How can goodness come down to will? How can will come down to wisdom? They're just different powers. So, the trick would be to say, you're right about human wisdom, and human will, and human goodness. They don't come to the same thing. After all, we have people who are wise and who are wicked. We have people who are good and who aren't so wise. Right? So the human beings are definitely different. But God's wisdom and God's will and God's goodness all come to the same thing. Okay, that's nice. But then I realize I have no clue how to describe God's wisdom and God's goodness and God's will to make them all come into the same thing. I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to describe them so they sound like goodness and wisdom and will in terms I can understand. Then I put the qualifier, but it's God's, it's not ours. And all of a sudden I can see how they all go together like equiangular and equilateral. Nobody knows how to do that. So here we have a picture of what we can't do. That's what we really have. We have a picture of what we can't do. But that's the truth. The truth is that He is what He is all because of His own single inner nature, whatever that is. And all the things we say about it, or would like to say about it, all have to come out of that one thing. They have to all be the same thing. And that's another way of seeing why we can't talk about it. Because for us, we don't have a language in which to make something like that meaningful. As he says, admittedly, this is something far beyond the grasp of our understanding and imagination. It's even hard to put it into words.
This is why it has negative attributes?
Yes. Yes. This is why there is a... One explanation, well, I didn't talk about this to you, and he seems to have a great deal more than probably most of you. Let's leave it. I'm not going to describe the whole doctrine of negative attributes, but it is correct. Yeah.
In accordance to this, according to Ramban, you couldn't even say that the God is infinite.
That's what you said, right? You know, sometimes when you use a word, you're saying something positive that you understand. And you can give a concept for it. And you can explain how you know it. Sometimes when you use a word, you mean to say only something negative. You say, well, it's not this. So then what is it? How is it? How did it get to be that way? What can I do with it? I don't know. It's just not this. Now, infinite might mean just, it's not like anything I know. Because all the things I know are finite. And it's not like any of those. If that's all you mean by infinite, just not like anything we know, so then, yeah, I could say that. Because it's purely negative. It's just a confession of ignorance. I can't give you anything to use to describe it because it's not like any of the things we know. Let me tell you a little story. You know what fractions are? There was a time in the Greek history when people thought there are whole numbers and fractions, and that's it. Now, they're easy to understand. A whole number is, you know, the number of apples in my pocket, or the number of dollars in my bank account, or counts things. A fraction counts pieces of things. Give me a quarter of the cake. Three quarters of the cake. 7/8 of the cake. No problem. Could there be a number that isn't a whole number and isn't a ratio? Huh? Negative number is not a problem. That's the number of dollars I owe. When I say I have minus $6, it means I owe $6. Yeah, or a simpler one that the Greeks already discovered is not a rational number. Square root of 2. The square root of 2 is not a whole number, and it's not a fraction. How do you know? You know there are lots of fractions, huh? How many fractions do you think there are? Oh, you know the answer to that? It's infinite, right? See, there's one half, one third, one fourth, one fifth, one sixth, one seventh, one eighth, one ninth, right? They're going to go on forever, and we haven't even gotten started. What about two fifths and two sixths? We left them out, right? And what about for the 13 47ths? We left that out also, right? So there's obviously an infinity of them. Now, how could you check? How could you check that the square root of two isn't there anywhere? Well, the Greeks thought up a proof, a very clever proof. And I'll tell it to you, just because it's so surprising and it's so clever. You know what square root means, right? Square root means if you multiply the thing times itself, you get the original. Square root of 4 is 2, because 2 times 2 is 4, or minus 2. So let's suppose, I really should write this on a board, or you can write it down if you care. Suppose the square root of 2, I'll throw it in the fingers, you'll find it. Suppose the square root of 2 is a fraction. So it'll be equal to A over B. Okay, square both sides. Now you get 2 equals A squared over B squared. Okay, now multiply both sides by B squared, or if you learned as I did, you can cross multiply. So you get 2b squared equals a squared. Now, reflect. If a squared is 2b squared, then a squared has to be even. Because it's double something. Mm-hmm. So a squared is an even number. Now how could a squared get to be an even number? What must a be? If a squared is even, then a has to be even. Because odd numbers, when you multiply them times themselves, give you only odd answers, not even ones. So now I've come to the conclusion that A has to be even. Okay, fine. But now, if A is even, then A is twice something. Every even number is twice something. Even 2 is twice 1, right? 16 is twice 8. 24 is twice 12. So, if A is even, A has to be twice something. Call it P. So A is twice P. Okay. So what would A squared be? 4P squared. Ha! Now put it back in. Over here I have 2B squared, and over here I got 4P squared. Okay. Divide both sides by 2. Now I got B squared equals 2P squared. Oh. But then B squared is twice something, so B squared has to be even. Ah, but if B squared is even, then B has to be even. Guess what we have discovered? We have discovered that A and B had to both be even numbers. Now that's nuts! Why? Because we had a fraction. We started with a fraction, A over B, you know. You don't tolerate two even numbers in a fraction. You reduce it. This proof shows that if the square root of 2 equals A over B, A and B both have to be even numbers. It would be a fraction you couldn't reduce. And of course you can reduce every fraction. If it has two even numbers on top and bottom, divide by both by 2. You can always get rid of it. So it means, starting from the assumption that the square root of 2 equals A over B, we arrive at the conclusion that A and B both have to be even, which is ridiculous. Therefore, the square root of 2 can't be A over B. Well, I want you to know, just as a piece of history, when this was discovered, it caused a crisis. The Greeks were really, to a great extent, true intellectuals, and this really shook them. It shook their whole vision of the world. What is this thing? If it isn't a whole number, and it isn't a fraction, what is it? Where is it? Where does it come from? How do you build it? What do you say about it? What can you do with it? This question wasn't really solved until the 19th century. when the idea of real numbers that are not, by the way, you've heard the term rational numbers? That has nothing to do with thinking straight. Rational means it's a ratio of two whole numbers. It means it's a fraction. Rational numbers is just a fancy word for fractions. Real numbers are called irrational, not because they're nuts, but because they're not ratios. So the Greeks discovered this thing, and they had no way to deal with it. No way to describe it. No way to can you multiply it? Can you divide it? Can you add it? Well, what does it mean? So, I mention this because in human thought also there were crises of things that was discovered that there's something and we don't know how to deal with it. We don't know how to deal with it, don't know how to think about it, don't know how to understand it, don't know how to apply it, don't know how to use it. And it's really worse than that because if you're just playing with mathematics, so go, fine, you know, you can go home and play with mathematics in recreation. But suppose you have a triangle. Triangle will look like this with a right angle, right? If this side is 1 and this side is 1, then this side is
1 root 2.
Square root of 2. That's awful. I need this number to measure the length of the side. It's a thing in the real world. And it's not a whole number, and it's not a ratio. So what is it? It's really there in the world, and the thing I would use to measure it is something I have no understanding of. No understanding at all. That was a crisis for these people who cared about understanding the world. So, coming face to face with things that you don't grasp, you can't understand, and yet have to admit are real, is an old, old human experience. This is nothing unique to religion or to Torah. And you have to be able to live with it. Okay. Now he says, there's no way to learn about the Creator from the creation. By comparison, or by using the created world as a reference from which you could deduce things about the Creator. Again, I've mentioned this to some of you, but it's worth, I think, keeping in mind. Here's a crude analogy. It's not true in all respects, but it gives you a feeling for the gap between us and God. Imagine you're having a dream. Now, in the dream, there could be people and cars and airplanes, telephones, fax machines. There could be dragons and hobbits and pixies and pterodactyls, which probably belong all in the same. Another lecture for another time. Things could do funny things, you know. The sun could suddenly go dark, or water could run uphill, or you could fly, or die and come back to life. And it's a dream. Huh? What happens when you wake up? The dream disappears. You could be awakened in the middle of the dream, you know, loud noise or something. It's all going on. Bang! Disappears! Because there really wasn't an it, was there? There weren't the people and the cars and the fax machines and the sun going on and off and dying and being resurrected and flying and all the rest. That didn't really exist at all. That was just your dream. You exist and you're having a dream. Here's an example of... Imagine in the dream you're also there, which sometimes happens. You know, you're a character in the dream. And in the dream, you make a promise to somebody else in the dream that you'll do something. Now you wake up. Are you bound by that promise? You made the promise. The other thing was just a figment. It's not there. It was never real. It was never real. Now, think of the gap between you, the dreamer, and the characters in the dream. They're just figments of your mind. Your mind brought them into your experience, And when your mind stops thinking about them, they aren't there anymore. The gap between us and God is similar. Because He creates us. He creates us. He gives us our existence. Just like your dreaming mind gives the dream existence to those things in your dream. So His will gives us our existence. Our existence is utterly different from His. Just as the dream existence of the things in your dream has no relationship whatsoever to what you are and the world in which you live. So you're not going to be able, imagine someone who could peek around in the dream only and try to infer who you are and what you are. There's no way you can get a clue from that. Yeah.
Does that mean like dreaming is the closest we'll get to God?
No. There's a lot left out. Usually in dreams, you don't have the normal range of will. In fact, some of the scariest dreams where your will is trapped, when you want to do something and you can't do something. Life, our life, waking life, is full of decisions. Decisions where I know very well I can do this or I can do that. I consider and deliberate. You don't have that kind of experience often in dreams. And our world is subject to fixed, regular consequences. You know, it's not wild the way dreams are. It's not surprising at every turn that something happens which, you know, has no past and no future and no reference. So I don't think that would be true. But this one little aspect of it helps to illustrate something about how God relates to us and how our existence can't be analogous to His existence at all. That's why when God makes an agreement with us, it's really quite surprising. We ought to be surprised about that. How can a creator make an agreement with a creation? We're not on the same plane. You know, we're not in the same dimension. See, He sort of props us up. He gives us more than a dream character. He props us up and gives us a certain kind of independence which enables us to enter into agreements with Him. A covenant with Him. A bris. But that's not trivial. That's something which should be initially puzzling and requires some thinking about. How does He relate to us? We relate to Him at all? How could such a thing be? And as Ramchal says in his chapter on the Shema, when God chose to be king, and our concept of king is that you're made king by those who accept you. If you're not accepted, you're not king. For Him to have a title, a quality, a relationship that depends upon our acceptance is astonishing. How could anything about Him depend upon us? It would be like saying, you know, you are XYZ because the dream character said so. How could the dream character make you into something? He's only your dream. Here, God chose to have a relationship with us that's based upon our making it so. That in and of itself is an astonishing idea, which... this is a disanalogy with the dream, but it means you're sort of upgrading. We are upgraded as creatures above and beyond mere creatures to have some kind of semblance of independence, even though in truth we're not independent at all. Every move of the way we have to be supported by God's creativity. Okay.
What is this?
I didn't get
the right
date. Yeah, I let
this go. 4p squared over b squared.
What?
Radical 2.
That I know. Radical 2.
Radical 2.
Fine.
In order to get rid of radical,
you
have to square
everything. Fine.
2 equals a squared over b squared.
Fine.
In order to get rid of anything on the bottom, you don't want any denominator. 5 times anything by b squared.